Last week we were discussing Ahab's wars with Syria that are covered in the 20th chapter of 1 Kings. Any comment or question before we proceed on? This chapter talks about two battles, and the reasons for the battles was one, so that Ahab would know that God is the God of Israel. And the second is so that the Syrians would know who this God is. They had, for the second battle, they had said that in the hills, the God of Israel was more effective, but in the plains where they would fight next, their God would win. So God is going to show them as well that he's the God of both the hills and the plains. Now one thing that we commented on last week is that who had gone to whom prior to these battles? Did Ahab go to God, or did God send a messenger to Ahab? God sent a messenger to Ahab three times. Okay. Do we have any record of Ahab ever going to God? If we do, I don't know of it. Okay. I don't know that he ever went to God about anything. As a matter of fact, as we continue the study, he didn't even want to go to the prophets of God because he knew what their message was going to be, and it wasn't a message that he wanted to hear. And going to a prophet of God, I would consider the same as going to God. So they have this second battle, and the Lord gives them victory. And then there's a strange reading at the close of the 20th chapter. And this is where one prophet tells another prophet to strike him, and he doesn't strike him. He refuses to, and the Lord takes his life. What's all this about? What's this mean? Why is this in here? Pardon?
I don't know that I could hear just that little make up word. His word do it. He didn't do it.
Did God tell him to strike the prophet? Somebody walks up to you and says, hit me, you're going to hit him? Based on this, you don't want to die? Well, I don't know all the reasons that's recorded for us. And so I look at this and I say, you know, what can I learn from it? And I have an idea of what I can learn from it. It may not be useful to you, but I'll tell you what I get out of it. This says, a certain prophet, of the sons of the prophets, said to his fellow, that would be another man who is another son of the prophets, at the command of the Lord, strike me. So you've got who talking to who? You have a prophet talking to a prophet. And he tells him to do something that is not normal. Matter of fact, he would go against human nature to hit another man. But it's a prophet talking. So at the very least, what should the second prophet have done? Inquired of God. So, but he didn't. He just refused. And perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps God saw in this a prophet that would be unusable to him. And in God's judgment, you know, he brought about his death. I don't know. But I would say this, that here's a man of God that should have inquired of God. Now what that says to me is I should inquire of God. When I run across issues of life that I don't know what to do about, I need guidance. I need to inquire of God because I can't rely upon myself. I can't rely upon my own thinking. I've got to turn to God for His thinking. But it also reminds me of something else, and that is this idea. There's always things that we need to do that are distasteful. There's things in our life that we need to take care of that we don't want to do, which always ends in procrastination. I know that, but I'm not really talking about procrastination. I'm talking about doing those things that you don't want to do. As a parent, there's times when you need to have a talk with one of your children. Something maybe is going on in their life, but you dread the talk. So do you do it or do you put it off and not do it? Elders, there's times they need to talk to a member of the church who maybe is beginning to walk disorderly. Sometimes they may dread that talk, depending on who that member is. They may be maybe somebody prominent, maybe somebody, you know, that otherwise has a good reputation, somebody that's well liked. And you might not look forward to that. There's things that we have to do in life that are not pleasing and not something that we would enjoy. But we have to do it. And that's one lesson I get out of this. The prophet didn't want to strike him. He said, I'm not going to hit you. Now, that's what God wanted. So we need to be careful, you know, that we do things that need to be done, even if it is not comfortable for us, not something that we want to do. And don't let it slide. Any comment or question? The next account in this and the next question in the handout is something that you're all familiar with, Naboth's vineyard. And this is one of the most harrowing accounts that we've got in the treatment, you know, of a person outside of, say, Christ himself. And how did this account start? What was the conversation at the beginning of this account? What was this all over? Naboth had a vineyard and the king wanted it. Now, was it a rightful request by the king? In what way? Part of his inheritance. So, I don't know that it was even a rightful request to start with, but certainly it was within Naboth's right not to sell it. And the old law covered the inheritance. The king certainly should have understood that. In various places in the New Testament, the law, God controlled the selling of one's property. Leviticus 25 is just an example of a place. We're not going to turn there. Numbers chapter 27 talks about the distribution of the property after one dies. So after Naboth was killed, this property wouldn't have gone to the king. It would have gone as the old law had laid out for this property to be distributed. So this was something that involved the law. There was a warning in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Remember what happened in 1 Samuel 8? Without turning there, please. What happened in 1 Samuel 8? This is a chapter that should stick out in our minds. This changed the whole course of the Old Testament. They rejected Samuel, they rejected God, and the appointed king. Okay. So, it was said in the 14th verse when Samuel was talking to the people about what the king would do, one of the things said is he's going to take your choice vineyards. Here's an example of where the king takes a choice vineyard. But he not only takes the vineyard, the man who owned the vineyard is killed. Now, what do we learn about Ahab in this reading? What do we learn about him? He asked for the vineyard, even willing to give him another vineyard. Naboth says no because it's inheritance. What is it then that the king does? Pouts. And it's descriptive of his pouting. I think we had just gotten into this. It says he lay down on his bed, turned away his face, and would eat no more. Now, spoiled brat. He was a what? Depressed? Oh, I thought it was spoiled brat. Okay. But, you know, this is something that we try to work out of a three-year-old, you know, is this type, you know, of attitude that we see here. And when you think of this, you can read over it, but keep in mind, this is the king. This is their leader. So you can imagine the way the nation is being led with someone who thinks like this. But he has help, and we've already talked about that. Who is the one who enticed him? His wife. So now she finds out that he's pouting, and she asks him, why is your spirit so vexed? And he tells her, now, I want you to think of something. Every day we live, we're writing our epitaph. Except God's going to be one that writes it. It's not going to be a newspaper that always finds something good to say. God's going to write it. And he's going to write it based on how we live. We'd like for God to have good things to write. But I look at these next few verses as the epitaph of Jezebel that God has written. Notice the first thing that she says in verse 7. Do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. The first thing she says is, do you not govern? The king could use his position as king for his own selfish purposes. Remember Rehoboam? Didn't take the counsel of the older men, took the counsel of the young, so he could use the kingdom for what he wanted to use it for. The counsel of the wise men, the older men, had said, if you will serve the people, they will serve you. We see here, perhaps even a higher degree, that attitude of I govern for my own purpose. It's for what I can get out of it, not for what I can do for you. That's the first thing that I see in Jezebel's response. And then notice what she says next. She says, arise and eat bread and let your heart be cheerful. She says that happiness is obtained through material possessions. I will get you that vineyard. Be happy. Arise and eat. That's the downfall of so many people. And we need to be careful that we don't develop that attitude toward materials, material things, and that being the source of our happiness. We'll never be content if that's what we look toward. But yet we see that's her. Then notice what she does next. She wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent letters to the elders and the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city, and said, proclaim a fast. Set Naboth at the head of the people, and set two worthless men opposite him. We see here that she assigns no value to a man's life. It doesn't mean anything to her. Actually, she assigns more value to obtaining the vineyard than she does to the life of the man who owns it. So she sets up false witnesses, and it ends up with him being stoned. And notice that in doing that, she set two false witnesses against him, charged him with using the king. She had, as we already read, she had sent the letters out. She had used the king's own personal stamp on the letters, so it went out under the king's authority. So we see this conniving nature, you know, that she goes to effort to plan this and see to it that she gets what she's after. You know, it's not just, you know, a thought, but she puts it into action. And it's a shame that, you know, a person would use their ability to do things and to accomplish things, to plan things, to purpose for things and see it through in such a way as this, is to take one's life rather than to use it in service for God. And then as we go on, the story tells us that he was killed. And word comes back to him, and then notice in verse 15. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise and take possession of the vineyard for Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead. He's dead. The callousness, you see, toward this man's life. He's not alive. He's dead. It's yours now. Just, it's a matter of fact. He's dead. It's yours. There's times that we do things in our life that may have an aspect to them that would be repulsive. And I expect all of us can be listed under that number in some form or fashion, one time or another. But yet, we look at that and say, ooh, I shouldn't have done that. I was wrong. How could I have done that? But you don't see that with her. Her attitude toward what she's done is just complete dismissal. So I call that a callous attitude. It gets back to this idea of the man's life was not worth anything, but that possession was. And so we've got this vicious circle. You know, it starts out with she's got this power that she can use to her advantage, and it ends up in the use of that power in a manner that shows just a total corruptness. You've heard people say power corrupts. Well, I don't know if that's true in every case. I would say that it's not. But certainly in this case, you can see that carried to the extreme. Jim?
In this verse, it seems it gets back to selfishness. I got what I wanted.
Yeah.
Through those people.
Okay.
Succeeded through getting things in various ways, but it's right. Corrupt, deceitful, conniving ways. So I wrote that.
Okay. Yes. Well, Hebrews 12 talks about that from a particular standpoint, that parents will discipline a child often for the sake of the parents, not for the sake of the child. And that's kind of an example of what you're going at, maybe.
I just know it's easy for men to think I'm the head of family. So I can issue edicts and make expectations of family to do to me rather than come to the wives and children. And parents can do the same thing. Either children have desires and dreams or be their slaves rather than you. And it's pretty cool.
And I agree with you, and I'm glad you're bringing that out. Can everybody hear what he said? Steve needs to talk louder, doesn't he? It goes to every relationship that we have. Most relationships, let me just say this. A lot of relationships are not equal relationships. There's somebody that is in a position over another in a relationship, husband and wives, employer, employee, slave and master, elder ruling the church, government, obviously, throughout, you know, relationships. Many relationships are not equal relationships. There's always this chance, the one at, with the higher level, being able to take advantage of that. And Steve's right. It's a good point. Whatever your position is, you can't take advantage of it in that sense, in the sense of to the hurt of the people that's under you.
Jesus talked about that when he walked inside the
speed. Yes. So I would encourage you to think about that in the relationships that you have with others. I would encourage you to think about your daily life, because we're writing our epitaph. Actually, God's the one that sees it, and he's the one that's writing it for us. And it's going to be based on what he sees. So let's live our life such that God writes the things that we would want written.
You know, you read the story and you look around, it just keeps going on and on. From the beginning of time until right now, you see people doing the same thing. Killing people, taking what they want. Me, give me. Nobody has an attitude of, well, I'm supposed to help my neighbor, I'm supposed to do this. And you look at these stories like this here, I'm supposed to help you get out of that.
Well, when God moves out of one's life, what moves in? Well, be more specific than the devil. Be more specific. Self, evil, materialism, something moves in. You know, it's true in this spiritual concept. The same is true in the physical laws of nature. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to develop a complete vacuum. Because as the gas in this chamber is sucked out, something is trying to get in. And so in our lives, when God comes out, there's not going to just be an emptiness in the sense of a vacuum. Something's going to come in. Okay. And I think a part of them did die. Yeah. Now, what was God's reaction to this? Okay. She says he reacted by punishing Ahab, and we see that... Put it off. Okay, and we'll see why. Yeah. The word of God came to Elijah, go to meet Ahab. He's in the vineyard where he's going to take possession, and you shall say to him, have you killed and also taken possession? And then in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick up your own blood. And so that's the message that Elijah gave to Ahab. But notice it said to Ahab, who did it? Did Ahab tell his wife to do this? Do we see that Ahab had a part in the plot? Well, she used his seal. I don't necessarily take that to mean that he knew she was doing that. I don't know. But we know this. God held him responsible. Now, I personally think that he knew what was going on and he did nothing to stop it, is what I think. But God held him responsible. So, good point. Good point. He didn't come back after she said, he's dead, it's yours. He didn't say anything about what happened. You're right.
Well, whatever he might have known or not known, he's what nowadays we call accessory after the fact. He benefited from her actions. He must have known by the time that I just showed up what had actually happened. But he did nothing to undo that. He allowed himself to simply do this, correct?
We've seen, and we'll see it again. You remember when David was king, and I may have some of the facts a little bit out of kilter here, but was there not a plague that came on the land for something that happened during the days of Saul? Remember that? I see a puzzled look. I think it involved the, was it Jebusites? The men that had made a covenant with, this may have gone all the way back to Joshua. And, Gibeonites? I'm not for sure. But they'd made a covenant many years, sometime earlier. And the covenant had not been kept. David had nothing to do with that. But the people were being punished because of that. Now, that's, I'm not trying to get into that, but I just want you to think, you know, from this perspective. And that is, God requires us, expects us to make correction of wrongs. He doesn't want us to leave a wrong unattended to. So if we've got wrongs in our lives, that maybe we're sorry that we did that, but if there's something that we need to go back and correct, then we need to go back and correct it.
Beginning as far back as the Garden of Eden, God punishes people who caused others to sin. He started with the serpent, and he's gone forward.
Okay. Okay.
I have two sides of authority here. One we've already talked about, using authority for personal gain. The other, failing to use authority.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point. Yeah, he uses authority. Well, he didn't really use any authority. he took advantage of his position when he shouldn't have, and he didn't use his position when he should have. Good point. Let's move on into the Second Kings letter. And I want to look at this king who followed who followed Ahab. And we'll, Ahaziah, his son, became king. And we notice at the beginning of this reading, Ahaziah had a fall and was sick. And who did he go to for finding out about his sickness, if he was going to live or die? Who did he go to? He went to one of the false gods. He's really just followed in the path of his father, which is, in a sense, what you'd expect, and I'm more admirable of those who are able to break from their father. This king's name, as we said, was Ahaziah. What does the term Ahaziah mean? Did anybody find a way to look that up? I'm sorry? Right. What I read was whom Yahweh upholds, or whom Jehovah upholds, sustains, upholds. Now, this tells something about these men. He would name his son with a name that means God upholds. But yet, do we see any inclination of him toward God? It gets back to their concept of these gods of the Canaan lands and the God of heaven as being together, and that they worship the God of heaven through these idols. So he believes, evidently, by the name, way he named his son, that he's a follower of Jehovah. Now, I don't know what rationale of thought that he can pull all this together and still think that, but it's really amazing to, in my thinking, that that's the name of what his son would be. Ahaziah continued the ways of both his father and his mother, the ways of Jeroboam, and also in serving the Baal. And of course, death was pronounced upon him because of his reliance upon the gods of the Canaanites. And so he's, the punishment is that he's to die, and he does. And then the next king comes in. And the next king is Jehoram. Now, there's one difference in chapter 3 in Jehoram and his two fathers, and his father and his grandfather. Well, actually, he's no son. I think he's not the grandfather, the grandson. He's also a son of Ahab, because Ahaziah did not have sons. Jehoram followed in the ways of Jeroboam, but what did he not do? He did not follow in the ways of Baal. So he actually put away the pillar of Baal that his father was made. So there is, you know, a positive thing in that light that can be said about Jehoram. Now we're going to discuss the death of Jehoram later on when we get to Jehu. So I don't want to get into that part now. And I want us to look to the prophet Elisha. Elisha made a request to Elijah about what? What did Elisha ask for? A double portion, okay. And a double portion of the Spirit of God. Now, we're not told exactly what that meant. I'll suggest this to you. When you go back in history and you look at this concept of double portion, it would have to do with an inheritance. Like the firstborn would receive a double portion. And And that would not only mean that he might get double of what the others in the inheritance would receive, but it also meant that he would be the leader of the family. And that perhaps is what Elisha is asking. If he can be the one who is the predecessor of Elijah in the sense of the spokesman for God. And Elijah says, I can't answer that. That's up to God. That's just a thought. I'm not going to go into all the miracles that he did. You can read them, and you've probably read them many times. The one I want to look at is Naaman. Here we've got this man that had come out of Syria to have his leprosy cured. The king sends him to, or they actually didn't send him to, but Elisha finds out about it. And he sends word to Naaman what to do. And we know the reaction of Naaman, and we know the servants talked with Naaman, and Naaman ended up doing what the servants said from Elisha, and he was healed. What was it that that Naaman said about the River Jordan? It was dirty. And the rivers in Damascus were what? Were better. Okay. I find it interesting when you go down in verse 15 and he says, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Well, there actually is a God in all the earth, because God is not just the God over Israel. But for him, that's a good statement. As the Lord lives and before whom I stand, I will receive, actually Elisha talking. Naaman says, if not, please let your servant be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth. Now, why does he want 2 mule loads of earth? I find it humorous that the waters of the Jordan are not good enough, but the dirt of Israel is good enough. I just kind of found that humorous. But then he makes a strange request. He says, from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offerings or sacrifice to any little g god but the Lord. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship him, leaning on my arm. And I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this manner. Isn't that a strange request? When I go into the house of the idol and I lead my master and he's to worship and I myself bow down, pardon me. Now, we all know, you know, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how they wouldn't bow down. And we've learned, you know, many lessons from those men. But here we've got this man saying, pardon me. And what was Elisha's response? Go in peace. I'm not suggesting at all that this is an example for us to follow. I'm not suggesting at all that we can continue in our sin. I'm not going there because I don't believe that. But I think of what was said in Acts 17, where God said, in the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. There were conditions of people that I don't know how God looked at. And I don't know what God's ultimate decision was on this as far as a judgment. I just find the request itself was interesting.
If anything God has never tolerated, it's idolatry. It seems like he tolerated a lot of things. But it looks like he never tolerated idolatry. I doubt that Naaman went into the house of Rimmon to worship.
I'm sorry?
I doubt he was going in there to worship. He was going in there as a civil servant. he would bow because he would civil servant at king. He would be somewhat like someone in England today, a company of the queen. It's a state religion. It doesn't mean they agree with, but as a servant of the queen, they would be respectful. And so,
And I agree with that, because it's written earlier that he would not worship the false gods. You know, he would worship the God of Israel. That ties in with what he said. And I'm bringing it up from the mere aspect of just the physical obeisance, not from the heart, so to speak. And I said that again from the standpoint of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could have said, well, our heart is not in this, but we'll do it, just from the physical aspect of it. But I agree with that comment. But it's just one of the points that we never talk about when we talk about Naaman. I gave you a handout on prayer, and we'll pull that out. Looking back at 1 Kings 17, it says, Elijah says to Ahab, there shall neither be dew nor rain these years except by my word. And then in chapter 18, beginning in verse 41, Elijah says to Ahab, go up, eat and drink, for there's a sound of rushing of rain. And Elijah sends his servant up on the top of Mount Carmel to look for rain, and, you know, ends up sending him seven times. And the seventh time he sees a small cloud, and from that a great rain comes. And then I refer you to James chapter 5. And the reason I do that is because this event is referred to there, and it said that it was the fervent prayer of a righteous man that avails much. And then it said, coming out of that statement, that Elijah, having a nature like ours, a man like we are. In other words, it's not talking about Elijah being a prophet and having, you know, a special gift, because that nature of Elijah is not like us. But it talks about him and comes back to this episode, and we see that it was Elijah's prayer that brought about this drought. And then it was Elijah's prayer that brought about the rain 3.5 years later. So I wrote this handout for you to think about prayer. And I hope you read the opening paragraph. And I want to key on the questions I write at the end of the opening paragraph. Sometimes we pray, but we don't know what to pray for. And we don't know what answer to expect. So, I wrote these principles that may help guide us in some of the thinking in our prayer. And I hope you took some time to read these. I want to go to point D, what one receives in answers related to his faith. And then to Roman numeral 6, 1 Kings 17, 14. This was the widow in Zarephath that was fed by God through the miraculous filling of her jug with oil and her flour for the time of that drought. But I want to ask you a thought. Could God have provided for that widow through providence without, you know, the visible miracle? Could he not have done that? What I want you to think about is that God is not limited to the miraculous in his work. He can work things, on one hand, through miraculous. He can work things, in another hand, through providence. And that's what I want you to think about. I want you to look at the last section, section F. God's answer is subject to his will. And we're familiar with James 4, if the Lord wills. 2 Corinthians, where Paul had said the thorn in the flesh, he prayed three times for God to remove it, but God didn't. And I gave a what-if account of Obadiah, the prophet who had hid the hundred, the man over the house of Ahab that had hid the 100 prophets. I can see in my mind that while Elijah prayed for it not to rain, Ahab might have been praying for it to rain. So you've got two righteous men praying for opposite things, and both are righteous prayers. What's the difference, you see? One served the will of God, and the other didn't. So no matter what we ask for, we have to always keep in mind the will of God, that we don't know what it is unless God reveals it to us. If you got any question on that, you can get with me. But I just wanted you to think about that. Thank you.